Hey, everybody. Today on the Charlie Kirk Show, super important episode. Stop what you're doing and listen to every word of this. You are going to love it. But before we get into it, please consider supporting us at charliekirk.com/support. At charliekirk.com/support, that is your portal to help support us. Our team, our researchers, our editors, the travel costs, everything around the production of the Charlie Kirk Show. You know, with all the cancellation and all the bad guys coming after people that are trying to tell the truth, when you support us at charliekirk.com/support, you are saying no to cancel culture. You are saying no to the digital assassins. You are saying yes to this program. And if you say to yourself, boy, I want millions of more people to listen to this program, I just wish my kids, my grandkids, my neighbors, and more students would hear what this show has to say, that's where it all is made possible, at charliekirk.com/support. As always, you can email us your questions, freedom@charliekirk.com. Action-packed episode, everybody. Thank you for supporting us. Thank you for emailing us. And also, get involved with Turning Point USA at tpusa.com. Can't forget that. Buckle up, everybody. Here we go.
Charlie, what you've done is incredible here.
Maybe Charlie Kirk is on the college campus.
I want you to know we are lucky to have Charlie Kirk.
Charlie Kirk's running the White House, folks.
I want to thank Charlie. He's an incredible guy. His spirit, his love of this country. He's done an amazing job building one of the most powerful youth organizations ever created, Turning Point USA.
We will not embrace the ideas that have destroyed countries, destroyed lives, and we are going to fight for freedom on campuses across the country. That's why we are here.
It's great to be here. Thank you, everybody. Thank you. Thank you. We are continuing our tour here, and I'm glad to be here in Minnesota. Unlike some people who run for president, I actually get the states right as we travel. We were in Michigan yesterday, and I've been looking forward to this one for a variety of different reasons. First of all, I just love Minnesota. It's a really nice place. Here's just some advice. Just don't totally mess up this state. It was built by wonderful Scandinavians, and it seems as if it's just being destroyed now. Rather intentionally, we're actually going to talk about that because my whole family's actually from Austin, Minnesota. Many generations back from Austin, Minnesota. Yeah. So, and also Marshallton, Iowa, so not too far from here. Grew up in Chicago, but many generations passed. So we have a lot of Minnesota ties here. And I was looking forward to coming to this specific stop, like Little House on the Prairie, this kind of idea of small town America, which feels as if we're now intentionally destroying that. And so I grew up listening to someone who I fundamentally disagree with on many issues, but I don't think he ever was characterized correctly, and many people not in college will know this name. Maybe you guys will know Garrison Keillor. And, you know, Garrison Keillor obviously wasn't Little House on the Prairie, it was Prairie Home Companion. And he was always kind of this national public radio voice for Minnesota, 800 radio stations across the country. And he got Me Too'd in like 2017 or whatever. But I think that in some ways, the Garrison Keillor wing of the American left is gone and dead, where his whole approach was that there's something profoundly beautiful about small town America and that there's something special about the family. And what was that? How he opened up every broadcast or closed it. He said, we're like the men are above, like children are above average and the women are, you know, super strong, whatever it was, kind of this like sign off that was like really kind of quaint, romantic and made you chuckle. But the whole idea of kind of the Garrison Keillor, you know, Prairie Home Companion was that maybe we shouldn't hyper corporatize our entire lifestyle and all move to cities and become childless and godless, that maybe there's something worth preserving and conserving. And he would call himself a left winger. I never actually thought that. He might have had really socially liberal policies, but the idea that all of a sudden towns like Mankato and he called it like Lake Wobegon, which was the famous lake that he used to talk about, is we've seen this massive trend in the last couple of years, especially of rural America being destroyed and allowing just like all moving to kind of these urban centers of madness, Minneapolis being one of them. We're going to talk about Minneapolis, where the founding fathers warned us about this, where they said, if you become too concentrated in these urban areas are prone to rumor with a spice of madness. I just kind of love that. That's what James Madison said, where it's going to be these kind of combustible centers of activism, where if you're a farmer and you're actually in touch with the land and you know the person who educates your children, you know the pastor, that's the truest form of local government. And this country was founded on thousands and tens of thousands of fictitious but actual cities like Lake Wobegon that Garrison Keillor once talked about. And so kind of coming to a place like this that doesn't quite honestly get as much attention, usually people just go to Minneapolis or wherever, was something that we really wanted to do for a variety of different reasons. But also I think it's profoundly important that we as conservatives don't overindulge in this idea of everyone move to the cities and stop having families and stop owning property. I think the trend should be the opposite, actually. I think that we should defend small town America and say that there's something profoundly beautiful about it. And so we'll talk about that, and you could tell me why I was wrong about Garrison Keillor. I'm sure he has plenty of shortcomings and failures. He was kind of a sarcastic snob in a lot of different ways. But I think he was onto something, and I think the American left has just dismissed that entire view. In fact, they have nothing but contempt for this part of the world. And so, but what I want to open up with, in addition to that, is kind of why we named our tour what it is. And some people have been, you know, very opinionated about what they think we're talking about here, but CRT is now everywhere, whether we like it or not. It's in our schools, it's in our military, it's in our corporations, it's in our political process, critical race theory, wokeism, whatever you want to call it. It's a very simple ideology. We don't have to overthink it. If you guys want to ask questions about it, we can go into the actual intellectual roots of it. But it's this idea that somehow the systems we have in front of us in our country are systemically unjust. They're actually racist. That if you're a white person, whether you realize it or not, you're participating in this racist experiment. That you must now endlessly apologize for things you didn't do, but simply what you look like. And I could go through example, and some for example, let's just use Atlanta public schools, where they're segregating white kids in one classroom and black kids in another classroom, in a second grade classroom in Atlanta public schools. United Airlines has come out and they said they want 50% of all the new pilots that they hire to be black pilots. Now, I have no problem with black pilots, obviously, but are they now going to be prioritizing competent pilots or pilots with a certain melanin content in their skin color? Now, I know for you, I want to make sure the pilot that's hired in the plane I'm riding in actually knows what they're doing, not like check some sort of diversity quota box. I mean, you go to your doctor, you're like, hey, okay, it's not that I want to see the best doctor if I have a tumor, I have cancer. You know what? I want a diverse doctor. I mean, what's really happening here is the deterioration of competency and the elevation of diversity. So this is where it all comes home here, is that just 70 miles down the street and an hour 20 minutes north, our country profoundly changed. And this is the other reason why I wanted to come to Minnesota, because we're going to participate in all sorts of thought crimes here tonight. So buckle up. It's going to be a lot of fun, which is, thank you, which is, on May 25th, 2020, up in Minneapolis, a cell phone video changed the trajectory of our entire nation in this state. The reason why our tour is called the CRT Tour is because of George Floyd's death and the misinterpretation of that. And I'm not going to go on this endless soapbox defending Derek Chauvin. I think he's kind of not a great person. But I am also going to offer some context and some nuance about the death of George Floyd that no one dares to say out loud, which is that this guy was a scumbag. Now, does that mean it deserves to die? That's two totally different things. Of course not. But the idea that someone who had 10 times the legal limit of fentanyl was illegally counterfeiting, trading counterfeit currencies, was resisting arrest and previously put a gun to a pregnant woman's stomach, who then dies, according to the first medical examination for the Hennepin County Examiner, said he died due to asphyxiation or a drug overdose. The second, the medical examination said it was due to suffocation or due to the knee on the neck, that somehow we must say, you know what? Let's profoundly restructure society. And that's what happened, is that one video in one moment of highly emotional footage that was a lot more complicated and nuanced than anyone ever wanted to admit at the moment did what? All of a sudden says, yeah, you know what? This American project's been going really well. Instead, let's put white people in one classroom, black people in another classroom. Western Washington University has come out and they have black-only dormitories. Columbia University has come out and they have black-only graduation ceremonies and Hispanic-only graduation ceremonies. Why? Because of one cell phone footage that happened on May 25th, 2020, right down the street. And here's why, is that we as conservatives, and what do you want to call yourself, you know, pro-American, pro-freedom, whatever, you know, there's this old quote that if you label me, you negate me. I'm happy to say I'm a conservative. I'll tell you why. But it's like not a woke person. I guess that's a fair categorization for most people nowadays, hopefully, is that is that we look at one of the mistakes we've made is that we underemphasize the power of visual and video medium. And in that one video was everything the activists needed to revolutionize society. So you had a white man and a black man, literal knee on the neck, which before that incident even happened, was kind of this incantation that they would say that white America has a knee on black America's neck. And then in addition to that, you had someone that just wasn't a random white person. You had a police officer. And the police officer, which many of us know, represents the administration of the law. So many activists could say, see, that right there is what we've been talking over the last 30 and 40 years. And immediately, instead of acting patiently and prudently and slowing down and saying, hold on a second, is this an isolated incident? Is this happening on a daily basis? We then allowed, quite honestly, the most corrupt and disingenuous voices that any human being could possibly find around anything to completely and totally reorganize society. And this then, of course, happened with the entire summer of what they call the racial reckoning of last summer, you know, otherwise known as Floydapalooza, when we decided just to destroy our entire nation. And where it's as if, like, I'm so angry about systemic racism, I'm going to go burn down a Wendy's. Like robbing Adidas sneakers from Mall of America is not going to bring George Floyd back, right? That's a very obvious thing. But if you dare say that, they call you a bad name, which, again, couldn't really care less. We're going to say things that are true. And so what ended up happening throughout June and July of last year, $2 billion in damages, by the way, after that specific incident, America's actually become a less pleasant and more dangerous place to live. Murders are up 30% since May of last year of what happened here in Minneapolis. I'm not sure really the state of affairs of what's happening in Minneapolis, but they tried to defund the police. They slowed private security. What is kind of the latest there? I guess they're sort of half defunding the police. It's a more dangerous place to live. All of you know that. If you're going down to Minneapolis, it's not the town it used to be. And so right on that corner of Chicago Street and 38th Street where George Floyd died, all of a sudden we as a civilization said, you know what? Our entire history of the rule of law, of the administration of such, separation of powers, checks and balances, independent judiciary, presumption of innocence, you know, trying to put criminals off the streets. Let's throw that all out. Instead, we need to reconsider and recalibrate society as we know it. And the damage is real, is what I'm here to tell you tonight. And tonight, as we do this tour, we need to stop and realize how severe and real of a mistake we have made as a country to allow it to go as far as we have for this long. That here we are in October 2021, and every single metric you can imagine of violent crime is going up. Now, it's not necessarily going up in rural America. It's actually the very communities that they say they want to help and serve, Black and Hispanic communities, where their communities are actually becoming more dangerous, more violent, and a less safe place to live. But kind of embedded into this entire narrative is, and that's why this one video was so powerful in some ways, was that this is a caricature of what's happening every single day. That Black people are being gunned down simply because of the color of their skin. Now, this is also why the nuance around the Floyd incident was so incredibly misleading, is that Derek Chauvin actually had multiple interactions with other Black people throughout that day and did not single out George Floyd because he was Black. Did you know that George Floyd actually in the video asked to be put on the ground? That he was the one that is actually resisting arrest? And now, again, people conflate that with say, Charlie, do you think he deserves that? Of course, that's not what I'm saying. Obviously, what I'm saying is you watch the video, the actual police cam video, there's back and forth going there, where he says, I can't breathe 7 times before he actually goes down onto the ground because he was actually probably already experiencing a drug overdose well before that incident actually happened. But when you actually look at the statistics, not only have we been lied to, but it's an Orwellian trick. It's the opposite of the truth. Not only are Black people not being gunned down because of the color of their skin, the opposite is indeed true. That in community after community, police officers are restraining themselves to actually police many of these communities of color. I'll go through some of these numbers, which is you look at, so they say that they're being gunned, unarmed Blacks are being gunned down at a massive rate in America. Well, the police fatally shot 9 unarmed Blacks and 19 unarmed whites in 2019. More unarmed whites were gunned down and shot by police in 2019. In just the last 2 years, 19 and 20, 30 total unarmed Blacks were killed in 2 years. with 600 million police interactions. So you have 600 million police interactions, and you have 30 blacks that are killed that are unarmed. Now, if you actually go into those numbers, many of them are like they were reaching for the weapon. They were in a car trying to run over a police officer. Very, very nuanced. And so you're trying to tell me that we should completely restructure civil society for maybe 10 or 12 incidents in a country of 335 million people with 600 million police interactions. So in 2018, there were 7,407 black homicide victims. Assuming a comparable number of victims last year, those 9 unarmed black victims of police shootings represent 0.1% of all blacks killed in 2019. Yeah, that's the emphasis of the entire conversation in that question. And in 2018, you actually look at crime statistics. Blacks made up 53% of known homicide offenders in the United States and commit 60% of robberies, even though blacks are 13% of the population. So far, committing far more crimes than the percentage of the population are. Now, if you dare say these things, you will lose your job. You get kicked out of class. Guess what? I couldn't care less, because things that are true need to be said. That if you are afraid to read off crime statistics as they are, and there's a big conflation that sometimes happens. The major reason why the black community unfortunately gets into a cycle of crime and violence is because they're missing the most important ingredient that BLM refuses to talk about: strong men in the household, putting fathers back into the household. And instead, they want to talk about a war on police and systemic laws that are written incorrectly or whatever they might be saying. And so you have in Chicago today, Kim Fox, who is a kind of like the perfect example of what happens when critical race theory gets implemented into law. She released 5 gangbangers just back onto the streets, even though there's cell phone footage of a gunfire back and forth of 2 gangs shooting at each other. And one person was killed. And she says there was insufficient evidence, even though you could very well see, and they all but admitted to it. Even Lori Lightfoot, who I'm not a fan of at all, has come out and said that this is going to make Chicago a much more dangerous place. But Kim Fox says that you don't understand communities of color. You don't understand these dynamics. So at first, over the summer, we had to be told you can't break up night fights. Remember that whole thing? Now we can't break up gang fights, even though there's people that are being killed in the collateral damage. There are about 1,000 fatal police shootings every single year out of 385 million police interactions. Being a police officer is a hard job. There are bad cops. Of course there are bad cops. There are also bad teachers. There's bad of everything. Is the general police officer waking up trying to oppress people? Absolutely not. In fact, a general police officer wants to keep their community safe, wants to look after their fellow citizen and their fellow countrymen. And the assault on police officers is intentional, because police officers are what stands within this fixation on destroying the rule of law as we know it in America. We're seeing this happen, where we have now had 400,000 people that have illegally crossed into the southern border in the last 60 days, where the people that burned down Minneapolis, a majority of the people that did that actual violence that destroyed the small businesses in the black community, many of whom will never be tried for the crimes that they committed in Minneapolis during last summer. But if you dare walk into the U.S. Capitol building and take a selfie, they'll put you in solitary confinement and lock you away indefinitely. So it's not that we have the destruction of the rule of law. It's anarcho-tyranny. It's anarchy. If you do something that fits a certain subset of the regime, you can do whatever you want. But if you cross the line, then all of a sudden what? Merrick Garland, Attorney General of the United States, came out yesterday and said that we are going to use the FBI, Department of Homeland Security, to identify the threats, the harassment, and the violence, of which I've seen none, happening at school board meetings across the country. This is now a priority of the federal government of the United States, saying that if you're a mom showing up worrying about pornographic content being taught to your kids, or being worrying about critical race theory being taught to your 8-year-old. Now, the federal government says, not so fast. We might monitor your communications. We might track your social media activity. And so make no mistake, there is a clampdown on certain behavior if you dare disagree with a certain subset of ideas. And this whole kind of idea of critical race theory is a betrayal of the Western idea of the rule of law, which is this a very simple idea. We used to teach this in our schools, which is that all human beings deserve dignity, regardless of their skin color, regardless what they look like. All human beings are made in the image of God, that all human beings deserve dignity and equal application of the law. And so what we've seen is that entire premise being challenged. And so if you believe that all human beings have dignity, then you must ask yourself the question, what is more important, things you can change or things you can't change? Now, America at its best was always prioritizing human agency and action. And at our best, we are de-emphasizing things you cannot change. For example, you cannot change your racial complexion. You cannot change your biological parents. You cannot change the type of world you were born into at that very moment. You know what you can change? How hard you work, the type of character you have, the type of spirit and soul you want to develop. Those things take a lot of work. So America at its best would prioritize your own human action, not what tribe you're from, not who your parents were, not what sort of ethnic group you might be part of. Now, this is very obvious stuff, right? This is, all of you are saying, yeah, of course, that's true. Everything that CRT stands for, woke industrial complex, diversity, equity, inclusion, all this stuff, stands against that. Instead, it says, hey, what tribe are you a member of? Because what they say is white silence is violence, that if you have white skin color, you are instantaneously or automatically, I should say, privileged, that without you even realizing it, without you even knowing it, the society was built for you and by you and because of you, and you must sit down and shut up and take a knee so other people can advance ahead in front of you. That is then de-emphasizing your own human action, how hard you can work, the type of person you can be, the development of your soul, the improvement of your relationship with your creator, very basic Western ideas. And instead, it's elevating tribal politics and saying, you know what's the most important thing? Not human agency, not choice, not whether or not you make good decisions or not, not praxeology, which is a Greek, it comes from the word praxis, where you get the word practice from, which means the repetition of good choices that improve one's soul towards the good. No. Instead, it's let's just be super sloppy and lazy. Let's put the people that look like this over here, the people that look like that over there, to try to right the wrong of generations and societies past. And what's so disappointing about this entire thing is how many people that I thought would stand against it are going for it. Now, let me be very clear. This ideology, albeit sinister, albeit all these different things that I've gone through, I do not think a majority of Americans deep down agree with this. I don't. I think that there is a majority consensus that organizing people by skin color, by prioritizing not your actions, not your choices, not your deeds, but your ancestry and your tribe, I think most Americans generally reject that. What I do think, though, is most Americans don't know how to push back against this. They're afraid of the cost associated with it, which is, you're a racist, sit down and shut up, which is a real thing, by the way. You could lose your job, you could lose your friends, and CNN might say bad things about you. It's true. But also, I think that people are petrified and paralyzed to have a conversation on race in this country. And so as we were trying to plan this entire tour, we said to ourselves, well, if we're not willing to go into the issue that is dominating the number one thing that all of you are living through, then what good are we at Turning Point USA? And so here's the other question, is that when we used to do these tours, and I'm happy to talk about immigration, abortion, socialism, whatever you guys want to, by the way, in the question and answer. But I wanted to make sure that the remarks that we have here are framed around this idea that we're no longer in like an economics debate. High taxes, low taxes, more regulation, less regulation. I obviously have my preferences. No, this is civilization defining stuff. This is whether or not the mission statement of the American project is true or untrue. Are all men created equal, true or untrue? That's the question in front of us. Are all people made in the image of God? Is skin color a necessary prerequisite to organize society? So here's three questions that every person needs to ask when it comes to CRT, whatever you want to call it, diversity, equity, inclusion, wokeism, whatever. Number one, is race a characteristic that you care about in judging a human being's worth or value? The answer should be absolutely not. Why? Because they can't change it. Because that is racism, which is exactly why we put that word in. And let me be very clear for everyone that's watching at home, just to reiterate it. If you care about people's skin color, you are a bigot and a racist for believing that. That is racism, by caring about people's skin color and focusing on it. And you have like the kind of the Pope of CRT. You have this whole kind of like Mount Rushmore of Ibram X. Kendi and Robin DiAngelo and Ta-Nehisi Coates. I'll focus on Henry Rogers, whatever his name is, who's Ibram X. Kendi, who's come out and he says, okay, we now need segregation and discrimination today to right the wrong of segregation and discrimination yesterday. And so this is a really important point. I'm a Christian, and Christianity heavily influenced English common law, William Blackstone, the idea of presumption of innocence, due process, that you must be held accountable for you, that your salvation with your creator, you must get that right. You got to get in a relationship with your creator. You might have to accept Jesus into your life. That's a Christian idea. And I'm happy to go into that if people are, you know, want to ask about it. That's not the main point of this thing, but it is true. Which is no matter how hard your parents try, they can't save you for you. That you must be accountable for your own actions. Why is this important? Because Ibram X. Kendi believes that we must now hold you accountable because you look like people that did something wrong 150 years ago. Because you were related to them. Because you come from that bloodline. It is a breakdown of the Western promise, which is this, which is, it doesn't matter where you come from. Show me what you got. That's why we are always the envy of the world. You want to go live in a caste system? Go to India. It matters a lot who your parents are. Good luck escaping that caste. What CRT does is it implements a racial caste system into this country, where all of a sudden people are paralyzed. They say, well, maybe I've been a racist my entire life without realizing it. Maybe I've been this terrible and awful human being. Now, if that is true, and I always have to say this because, you know, so not everyone listens to everything I say, repetition of the soul of memory. We have a supply and demand problem with racism in America. There's an incredibly low, little supply and an incredible big demand to find it. If you happen to be in the very small percentage of a racist in the country, then you got work to do. Go get in contact with your creator quickly. Read the Bible. Ask for forgiveness to the people that you know. With that being said, just because you're of a certain skin color does not automatically make you a racist. Just because you're a white person does not mean you have to begin apologizing simply for how God made you. And so the second question, of course, is black-only dormitories, which is the resegregation. Ibram X. Kendi says, okay, the way we're going to fix inequity is now go back to segregation because this kind of idea of a multiracial, multicultural society, it's actually a false promise. And then the third thing I've kind of got into this is should people be punished by group? Should you be held accountable for not your own actions, but instead what jersey you're wearing? Is that the country we want to live in? I think it's really disgusting, actually, if all of a sudden we're going to be a country where your jersey is your skin color, where all of a sudden we feel as if the values we share is because of the melanin content in your skin. I honestly think that is a disservice to how incredibly unique, complex, and special every single human being is created. And if we want to go back to tribes, which is literally a 5,000, 6,000 year regression, then with it, we will throw away the centuries of interpretation of the Bible and the Constitution that says neither slave nor Greek nor Jew. We are all one in Jesus Christ. We are all one in the image of God. Where does this lead? Countries that tend to organize themselves based on race go into civil conflict very quickly. South Africa, Brazil. This idea of this many different people from this many backgrounds coexisting for as long as we have is actually remarkable. As I watched the race riots last summer, I couldn't believe that it was happening and we tolerated it. When I really thought about it and I kind of viewed the racial demographics in our country, which again, race means nothing to me. I think it's a unnecessary talking point. But if you look at the racial demographics in most countries, they'll have those race riots every month. Why? It's because if absent the American Trinity, in God we trust, liberty, and e pluribus unum, then all of a sudden you are going to get into tribes really quickly. That if all of a sudden you remove the core promises of America, what are you going to replace it with? There's not that many other things you can think of. We've basically experimented with every type of governmental model you can imagine. And I hate to be too binary about this, but there's only two ways you can organize every single government in the history of the planet. Do you emphasize speech in how you set up the government or force? It's that simple. Soviet Union, force. Communist China, force. Venezuela, force. America was supposed to be speech, meaning tell me your idea, and then I'll give you power. You got to run for office. You got to give a speech. You got to tell people what you're going to do. The capacity to speak and to reason is what makes us human beings. Aristotle said we are the speaking beings, which means that without speech, then we're nothing more than just warring conflict and tribes. And this idea of reason is a uniquely Western idea. And so why are we all here? And to kind of summarize it before we get to questions, is 70 miles down the street, all of that changed. And it changed for a variety of different reasons. Number one, the other side was ready. They were prepared to push all of these ideas. CRT did not start with George Floyd. It's been in the school system for a long time. And they went all in with a full kind of push at the moment that they saw fit. But more importantly, we were afraid as conservatives and unequipped to be able to launch a counter move by what we saw happening in front of us. I think that's changing. I think one of the reasons why so many people are here tonight and engaging and understanding is they say, whoa, okay, I might not like what I saw in the video, but all of a sudden you're now saying I have to totally change the way I view this issue altogether, that I have to read this book, How to Be an Anti-Racist, and I'm white fragile, according to Robin DiAngelo, the multi-million-dollar white author that tells you that you're a fragile white person. Like, that's like the new standard for philosophical exploration in our country. And we shouldn't put up with it, is what I'm telling you tonight, is that when bigotry enters the American discourse, we should not tolerate it. We should say, you know what? No. CRT is nothing more than a new manifestation of what leads us to eugenics, leads us to categorizing people based on skin color, and there is no good way this ends. Period. That I remember the America that I grew up in 10 years ago, that when people focused on this stuff, they would be called bigots and they'd be called racists. And because we've sent so many wonderful people to college, excluding everyone in these wonderful yellow shirts in high school, is that a major part of our population have been propagandized and indoctrinated to believe that maybe we are systemically racist. Maybe we are racist to the bone. Maybe the founding of our country was wrong since the very beginning. Happy to go into that if that interests anybody tonight. I did an extensive overview on that yesterday. Human equality is a fundamental value and American idea. Now, human equality does not mean we all have the same skills. It does not mean we have all the same outcomes. Some people are going to be smarter. Some people are going to be faster. Some people are going to be taller. What is human equality? That we're all the same sort of thing. That we're all speaking beings. We're mind, body, spirit, and soul. Pick word, whatever word you want. I prefer soul. Mind, body, and soul. That we deserve dignity and due process, the rule of law. And if you want to organize society, let's just say you get to a blank canvas. Do you want to all of a sudden say, hey, I want to try to design society in a way that empowers people and tries to make them better human beings, or disempowers them and keeps them in corners endlessly apologizing by the time they're 18 years old saying, I'm actually a terrible, bigoted, awful, racist, colonialist, imperialist, misogynistic, bigoted person, not because of something I did, but because of how my parents looked. That's where we're going. Where kids have to needlessly apologize, not because they did something wrong, but because they were born into a certain caste and tribe. We're not going to stand for that anymore. And so I believe, regardless of your political affiliation, I really don't care. I'm sure there's people all different political stripes here. This actually needs to be something where we look back on our history, and there might have been like a short gasp of this ideology, and it was repudiated by people of all different political stripes and colors. Obviously, I'm conservative. Obviously, I believe in the Constitution and American exceptionalism and all this. But if you even have like a remnant of admiration for America, then this should disgust you. Don't try to all of a sudden get in your right, left side and be like, oh, this is too much of a right-wing critique of CRT. Like, what did I exactly say in the last 20 minutes besides like all human beings are made in the image of God, human equality, speech is good, and we should treat people based on what they do, not what they look like, is exactly a right-wing critique of American society. The fact that anyone might even think that all of a sudden goes to show the exact reason why this is being implemented, which is this, which is power is most effectively assumed when tribes are at war. If we're getting along and we're living in harmony, there'll obviously always be some form of conflict. We're not trying to look at each other's skin color. What's your white privilege card? And do a privilege walk and all this. All of a sudden, the people in charge, they actually aren't given as big of a license to dominate and control your life. A country that respects each other, understanding the mind, body, and soul relationship, and kids, that is a preference, all of a sudden makes tyrants far less powerful. Aristotle had this beautiful thing in the fifth book of the Politics where he said, tyrants aim to make citizens unfamiliar to one another. They try to create distance between neighbors. They try to make countrymen distrustful of the people near them. Tyrants try to sow discord, chaos, and confusion. And when that happens, they're able to sweep into total control of a nation. And that was 2,500 years ago that he wrote that. It's just as true as it is today. People say, how do we stop tyranny? How do we stop the power grab? Happy to go through all of that. But their gateway to making you live in a Huxleyan or Orwellian nightmare is to have every single person screaming about skin color all day long, worrying as if that thing actually matters, while they plunder our society, destroy the American middle class, lie to us on television, force vaccines on our children, keep us masked up and obedient. They keep our borders wide open, but they want you distracted with this smokescreen grenade that they've thrown at us as if the most important thing is something you can't change. Don't take the bait. We're here tonight to say, okay, we can have our differences on every sort of issue. You know where I stand on all of them. Happy to go through it. But if we want this American civilization to continue, which is a gift from God, it is a gift from God that we get to live in this country, then we must reject and repudiate this insidious ideology. Okay, let's do some questions, everybody, and we're about to have some fun. So can line up here for some questions, and don't be shy, and we'll stay until they kick me out. And so I also want to thank our amazing Turning Point USA students. Give it up for them. They did an amazing job. Help organize this. Phenomenal. Question line's over there. We'll get that going. And I also want to just say for all of you guys watching on the live stream, these events are so hard to plan. And all of you to understand with the virus measures, the lockdown stuff, navigating these things, obviously our preference would be doing this on campus. But the entrepreneurship, the adaptation, the ability to kind of change on their feet. I've been so proud of our Turning Point USA students and staff not to take campuses saying, oh, we're not doing events. And like, we very well could have not done this. These issues and these ideas and the people we're impacting is far too important to all of a sudden take some administrator trying to shut us down as a reason not to do our tour. So I just want to say it's an amazing thing. Okay. All right, we will we'll go to the first question. I always say this. If you disagree, you're allowed to cut in line. And if someone says something outrageous, don't laugh at them, don't mock them, don't ridicule them. This is obviously a conservative audience, so if a liberal is speaking, give them the respect that they never give to us to allow their ideas to be spread. Okay?
Hi, Charlie. I have kind of a two-part question for you. So first, you talked about people like Ibram who actually came to speak at my college campus.
That's hilarious.
So what advice would you give to students like us who disagree with this, who want to fight back, but are fought every way? We're fought in every corner, every step of the way. We're trying to get a turning point on campus and not happening. Trying to take all these steps to fight back, and they're just fighting us at every step. And then part two of the question is, God willing, if I have kids one day, what do we do if it keeps going this way? I mean, homeschooling is always an option, but if we'd like to send them to school, what are your thoughts on that?
What school do you go to?
The University of St. Thomas in St. Paul.
Okay. Well, first of all, boo, right? Thank you for being here, by the way. So I want to open up by first saying, I don't have any easy answers when you experience opposition. For the young people in the room, raise your hand if you've been treated differently or graded differently because of your political affiliation or your ideas. Yeah, basically every single young person's hand goes up. Now for some of the parents and grandparents, they're shocked and aghast that we would live in that kind of country. Yeah, we do. You're going to pay a price if you disagree with the status quo. The best thing you can do is you have to make a decision and you have to make a choice of whether or not this sort of endeavor, which will come with opposition, it will come with backlash, it will come with mockery and ridicule against you, is worth it. Here's the two things I can promise every single Turning Point USA student. Well, first, you're going to all pay a price. No one likes hearing that, right? You're all going to lose friends, but you'll make new ones. You're all going to get kicked out of fraternities and sororities. Who cares about that stuff anyway? Your grades will be different. I don't really think grades matter that much, but maybe they do to you. But whatever. I think character matters. I would rather have courageous C students than weak A students. But, and so, and I'm not saying you can't be both. I'm not saying you can't be a courageous A student, but if I was forced to choose, okay? But here's the thing I can promise you. And I can tell you're frustrated. You're getting your teeth kicked in. You get to be something that most people in America wish you could be. The same person in public that you are in private. You do not have to pretend to be somebody that you're not. So you do not have to leave your apartment and go put on a camouflage and a disguise and go be like a woke person when you go to work. No, you'd be like, oh, this is what I believe and why I believe it. Don't want to hire me? Fine, I'll figure it out. If you want to call me these names? Fine, I'll figure it out. You act that way, you take almost all their power away. We have given them this kind of societal and cultural power by allowing them to all of a sudden tell us what is socially acceptable, to allow us to what sort of ideas are. And I'm not saying it's easy, because there's somebody in this audience right now that I know is getting a pit in their stomach. Like, man, Charlie, it's easy for you to say, I'm a nurse at a hospital, I'm about to be fired, because I'm getting forced to get a vaccine. If I dare say anything, I will tyrannically and autocratically be fired almost instantaneously. Easy for you to get up on stage and say that. It's not easy for me to say it. It's hard because I know the significance of the words that I'm saying. I know that there will be a price and a consequence. We do not do hopium at Turning Point USA. You know what that is? Hopeful things, opium, feels good. It's actually really bad for you. A lot of people will go on tour and they'll say this. Just stand for your beliefs and your life will get infinitely better instantaneously. That's garbage. That's lying to you. No, it actually might be really awful for the first 6 months, first year, 2 years. But you'll become stronger. You'll develop the metaphorical muscles to deal with this. A year from now, 2 years from now, 3 years from now, they won't be able to take anything from you. You will be a properly sold individual, which is what? Free. You'll be free. Free from what they can call you. Free from what they can throw at you. And so, heck yeah, man. You're gonna get all sorts of different backlash and ridicule. Don't give up. Handle yourself correctly, respectfully. Understand the position of others. Don't give them a reason to try to cancel you or silence you. Do not do things for the sake of provoking. But, people say, Charlie, you're always trying to provoke. That's not true. I say things that are true, and if it provokes people, that's their problem, not mine. Okay? So my intent is to say things that are true. So let me just say this. People like you are why we started Turning Point USA. Don't give up. Don't give in. We've heard all the stories. And here's the other thing. Resist the temptation, because it's there, even for me, to want to feel sorry for yourself. Wanting to feel sorry for yourself is the opposite of living a magnanimous life. A magnanimous man is one who's deliberate in its choices. It's a properly sold person. A magnanimous man is not anxious when they open an envelope or an email. I'm not that person sometimes, right? Sometimes you get a text message like, oh my goodness, what is this? A magnanimous man knows who they are and they know their place in the world and no one can take it away from them. Keep fighting. God bless you.
Hi, Charlie. Oh, sorry. Yeah. Hi, Charlie. I listened close to your speech. It was very good. It was a very detailed speech. I basically had a two-part question for you. After listening to your speech, I wondered, did you think that slavery and ensuing Jim Crow laws had a lasting impact on the black community in the United States?
Some, and that's a good question. So if you correlate all the impact of Jim Crow and slavery, I would say that you could generously say 26% single motherhood in the black community in the 1960s. So about 26% of all black babies born in the 1950s and 1960s were born to a single mother. Now it's 77%. So I would ask you, why did it jump 50% since the Civil Rights Act as America got significantly less racist?
So that's fine. I don't know why it jumped. That, who cares?
But well, it wasn't slavery or Jim Crow. It was something else.
So the only lasting impact that slavery had on the U.S. was that less black families had fathers.
No, not necessarily. But have you ever known anyone that's owned a slave?
No, but I know a few presidents who did.
You know them personally? So you don't know anyone that was ever a slave?
Well, no, because... So, okay, I don't know anyone who was a slave, so it had no impact?
No, it had some impact. The question is, did it have an impact that is measurable and significant enough now in 2021, where we saw a key metric that influenced the livelihood of the black community, like single motherhood rate, that as America got less racist, all of a sudden now 77% of black babies are born without a father, where before it was 26%. And I suppose the question is this, because this is the question about systemic racism, right? What law that is in practice today actively discriminates against black people?
So here's what I would say to that. The idea of capitalism in America, like you said, is it doesn't matter who you are, show me what you got, is fresh start. So what would happen if you had like 150 years in a country for your family to build wealth, to own a house, to have a job, to get college education for your kids, to build generational wealth. And then you took another family who didn't have the opportunity to do any of that for 150 years and then set them off on the same even starting point. Is that really an even starting point? And would that not result in some kind of systemic disadvantage for those people?
The black middle class was the fastest growing demographic in the 1940s and 1950s until the Great Society Act and that intervention. It's very tempting to do what you're doing. And I'm not faulting you for it because you've probably been propagandized to believe it. And that's okay, because I think you're actually a victim in this case because you've been misled to want to believe that things you never lived under, never understood, and that I think you are partially seeing had a disproportionate impact in the world that you're living in today. So, for example, if that were to be true, then first-generation immigrants would not be able to quickly be able to make good choices and move up the ladder in this country, which I think we have some first-generation immigrants here tonight. Now, let me say this, that this idea that America is systemically racist to the core would also be quickly debunked by the fact that more blacks have legally immigrated to America since the 1980s than ever were here brought as slaves. Over 2 million blacks from the Caribbean and from Nigeria and from Western Africa have come here to America. So the question is, why is it that in every statistic that you could probably rattle off, are black people doing worse than white people? What is it? Well, I would point to the fact that fathers are not in the home, because it was 26% of black females in the 1960s were single mothers. Now it's 77%. If you look at the Brookings Institution, a liberal think tank, there are three things you need to do to stay out of poverty in America. Number one, graduate high school. Well, because of public sector unions and the dominance of our government schools, that's harder than ever in far too many communities. Not just racial, not just black communities, not just Hispanic communities. The second thing, get a job, any job. And the third thing is to obviously not to commit crimes, but to try to get married before you have children. And so some of what I believe has contributed to the downfall of some of these communities has nothing to do with white people with the neck on black people. Instead, it's the following. Fathers no longer being in the home, the rise of sexual anarchy that came in post-1960s liberalism that removed this idea of sex being confined to a marital relationship to be gratuitous and everywhere. All of a sudden, you've seen an increase in the birth, in not just the birth rate, but the single motherhood rate and abortion alongside of it. I would just ask this question. I'm just curious. How much do you think outputs are based on people's decisions, based on the advantages they're born into?
I mean, as someone who's taken introduction to sociology, your life is greatly influenced by what the conditions you're born into. But I promise this will be the last thing. Just, you say there's less fathers in the home of, you know, many black families,
yes,
and that's the issue. So what do you think is keeping fathers out of the home in those?
It's a great question.
Do you think it could be over-policing and police arresting, like, disproportionately?
You went through this, everybody.
Do you think it could be law enforcement disproportionately enforcing laws in black neighborhoods and arresting more black males than any other demographic?
So blacks are actually under-arrested and under-policed per the percentage of crimes they commit. We talked about some of those numbers. But let me tell you one thing in particular. In the Great Society Act, we decided as a civilization to subsidize single motherhood. In the 1960s, we told black women, you no longer need to be married to have children. You can get married to the government. And we saw a dramatic escalation and increase of the deterioration of the nuclear family and a replacement of that, of the nanny state and the welfare state. And I would say this, that every single activist group that steps up, that talks about systemic racism and oppression, if you look at the data, purely the data, if there is a movement to put black fathers back in the home and to try and challenge the sexual anarchy that came in the post-1960s and had a more prudent and pious view of sexual relations in America, which is a very unpopular view, by the way, for most Americans, but it's true that before the 1960s, sexual relations were, at least culturally, supposed to always be confined to marital relationships. The more gratuitous that we have been in trying to catalog it in media and in pop culture and in Hollywood and, yes, in schools, then all of a sudden you have seen people say, well, why do I need to get married for that? Marriage is the bedrock institution, and strong families create strong communities, which create strong civilizations. And this is why immigrant communities that have come to America and first-generation immigrants, they're able to move so quickly up the socioeconomic ladder because they might not have wealth, they might not have big bank accounts, they might not own a lot of land, but they have the thing they know that will keep them together, which is a family that will not be broken up at any means necessary. I'll finally say this. Let me just say this. No, I want to thank you for coming because it took courage you to ask that question. I'm just going to ask you to do one thing. Please forget everything you learn in Introduction to Sociology 101 because it was likely all garbage. So thank you so much. If anyone disagrees, feel free to hop in line and, you know, okay. Maybe you disagree and you're working the event, so who knows?
No, I don't. Okay, hi. Okay, so I know you feel strongly about a lot of political issues. And I just want to know, what one do you feel the most strong about or, like, passionate about?
Most strongly about?
Like, that you just, like,
most
gets you fired up.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot, but if you really want to get me animated, yeah. is the million abortions that we accept in our country every single year. So that one definitely gets us all animated. You can't get basic things right, then I don't expect us to start to get the more complicated things correct. Life begins at conception. It shouldn't be hard to say that. I will go back to what I said earlier, which is that when all of a sudden a society accepts that sexual relations can be normalized outside of marriage, then all of a sudden you need to institute new forms of birth control and pleasure control, which is abortion. Million abortions a year. And that's 3,000 a day to give you an idea of how many abortions happen in our country every single year. And so it also disproportionately hurts black communities. And to kind of answer that previous question before, this is a tough topic to talk about because even some conservatives kind of want to participate in kind of some of the slow cultural landslide. And I think we have to be very clear of what is the ideal? What is the law of nature and nature's God? As Thomas Jefferson said. And I'm not here to proselytize a certain religious belief. I obviously have my own. But let's talk about what Thomas Jefferson said in the Declaration of Independence. What is the law of nature and nature's God? Here's a law of nature. Out of wedlock children is not good for anyone. It's not good for the parent. It's not good for the kid. It's not good for society. It's not good for the civilization. It's not good for the future of the country. That there is an ideal. That the ideal should be a man and a woman raising that child, pouring into them. That a daughter needs to see the type of woman she wants to become. She also wants to see the type of man she one day wants to marry. The man needs to see the type of woman that one day he wants to court and marry, and then maybe the man he wants to become. You remove one of those elements, it's not to say that it's impossible. There are some phenomenal single mothers out there that have been mistreated by weak men, that have been lied to by degenerate men, quite honestly, and I'm happy to get into that endlessly, that step up and raise amazing children. But the statistics show it itself. And I wanted to say this to the prior question, I forgot, which is that if you look at the data is very clear, which is that a black child raised by a mother and a father is far more likely to take all the different statistics that you would consider to be a success than a white child that is just raised by a single mother. That right there is the ultimate social safety net, which is stronger families. And this is obvious, but far too often, here's the thing though, is this is where I'll go a step further, and feel free to disagree and we can get in line, which is that I don't think we just have to talk about it as conservatives. I think we have to do something about it, which means that we as conservatives know that families are everything. But far too often we as conservatives say that, we're like, okay, now go make good choices. I say, wow, why don't we try to calibrate laws that actually try to defend families and make it easier to have children in our country, to make it easier. And now some conservatives get really nervous. They're like, I don't know, because that's government intrusion into it. Look, we're living in, unfortunately, a phase where government's intruding into everything. I don't like it. I wish we had limited government. I wish we were living in a society where everyone was able to police their own ideas and their own actions through the pursuit of virtue. But I've said very clearly that if we do not turn the corner on Americans having more children, then the civilization is over. You know what the number one reason why young couples do not have children is? Number one reason, too expensive. That's unacceptable. We have to start to think to ourselves, if you can't have children, then what good is corporate profits and building new weird buildings in downtown Minneapolis? And what good is that? I want an America where 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 kids per family starts to have a resurgence. I think the wealthiest people in America is not Jeff Bezos. It's the people that have large families. They are the wealthiest people in America. They really are. And that's an ideal. And I will say this. Too many young women make an ideal of a soulless corporate career when deep down they actually want to start a family. Don't prolong it. Go find someone responsible and go have a lot of kids. Thank you. If anyone disagrees, again, I just let it be known, the offer stands. Okay.
Do you want a drink of water first?
I already had one.
Okay, cool. I've got 2 to 3 things. First, I won't, my understanding is that slavery is still allowed within our penal system as a punishment. Is that not correct?
No. How would you say slavery is allowed?
That we've enshrined it in law that it is okay to use slavery as a punishment in our penal system. That's why they don't have to be paid minimum wage for work. And I just like to call out, I know that that's not around racism or anything like that. And it's just calling out that we still have slavery within our system, and that I know people who have worked in that system. I've had friends abroad who were slaves in the cotton fields in Uzbekistan. It's still going on here too.
Wait, okay. So I'm understanding. Your argument is that we have slavery in America because people who commit crimes aren't paid a minimum wage when they go to jail.
Correct. And I'm not saying that that's wrong. I'm just saying that still is slavery.
No, that's not slavery, okay?
Why is that not slavery?
Well, first of all, many of the prisoners actually want those jobs because they get a chance to actually build some income and get out of the cell and have a decent life. And here's the thing. I'm not really big into the prisoner sympathy thing, okay? You commit a crime and you go to jail. You're a rapist. You're an arsonist. You're a murderer. You're a money embezzler. And all of a sudden you get a chance to put together packages. You should be thanking us, okay? Enough of the swan song of feel sorry for me. I burn down buildings or whatever it is. So it's not slavery, okay? Slavery would be that you took a random citizen on the side of the street and be like, oh, you did nothing wrong. Go put together a bunch of gizmos and gadgets. Maybe your definition of slavery is different than mine, but...
You talked earlier about dignity of all humans. And there, it sounds like once you've committed a crime, your dignity is
gone. This is a great question. So when should dignity be removed?
I would argue never.
So, okay, let me ask you a question. So Ted Kaczynski, Eric Rudolph, and Timothy McVeigh, 3 people that randomly bombed American society, the Unabomber, the Centennial Park bomber, and the guy that bombed the Oklahoma City bomber, you should never take their dignity away?
Yeah, humans, as you said earlier, that once we start defining why you should take dignity away, dignity starts.
Well, how about murdering people?
Okay, there's a difference between allowing people to live in society and taking away their dignity.
Right, so Ted Kaczynski, Unabomber, should he not be in jail?
I'm not saying he shouldn't be in jail. No. I'm saying that
the rhetoric we use towards people shows whether we give them dignity and see dignity.
Right, like Ted Kaczynski was given dignity when he was a professor until he started mailing packages around the country and started killing random children. Then it's like, okay, you're going to jail for the rest of your life. That's a good use of power.
So, Charlie, when should people stop giving you dignity if you're going to have lines?
Because I'm not the Unabomber. Right?
Yeah, fair point. And do you understand where I'm saying of like,
no.
If we, okay, cool. If we claim that dignity is inalienable human right or given by God.
Rights could be taken away.
Okay, if dignity is given by God,
murderer,
can it be taken away by man?
Say that again, I didn't hear what you said.
If dignity is given by God, can it be taken away by man?
It could be taken away by the state if you make a decision to infringe on the life, liberty, or property of another. Therefore, an emphasis on what? Human action. So, for example, when someone goes and shoots up a school or a church like Dylan Roof, he all of a sudden has violated the social contract and social compact of life, liberty, and property of another. Therefore, we absolutely have a moral right and prerogative. In fact, we have a moral obligation to say that he should not be able to live in free society alongside of us.
Absolutely agree.
Okay.
That's not what I'm trying to say. What I'm trying to say is that we should still treat these humans with dignity, even when they are not allowed to be a part of society.
I mean, again, you're not going to convince me that Dylan Roof or the Unabomber are in some sort of vast need after they decided to take the life of innocent people. Is that the argument? They made a decision to take the life of another. At that point, the social contract has been violated, and we should, in fact, we have to use state power to take them out of the free and decent society.
I'm still not disagreeing with that. So, what I'm disagreeing with is how we use rhetoric and our thought patterns to view other humans, and we start to objectify them.
This is a good question.
Like
okay.
Going to...
I understand what you're getting, but let me ask you a question.
Oh, can I just finish real quick?
Yeah, fine.
Just like Nishek, that I agree with everything.
Nietzsche?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm really bad with German.
It's okay. So which book are you quoting that you learned in your intro to
philosophy? It's just the famous quote.
Yeah, Beyond Good and Evil. You know, which one is it?
Beware when fighting monsters, for you yourself become a monster. When you gaze into the abyss gazes back. And I hear a lot of rhetoric of tribalism. I hear a lot of undignifying of humans and objectifying of humans because of the wrongs that they've committed, which is, I agree. They committed wrongs. And, how do we get beyond this tribalism, get beyond this undignifying of humans from what they do?
How about this? Stop committing crimes and start improving your own character and your conduct. And then all of a sudden, I think society will start to figure it out. I guess my question is this, which is, you're worried about thought patterns and speech patterns. We right now in our country have thousands of people that have committed first-degree murder. They decided to take the dignity and the life of another human being. Excuse me while I don't dedicate parts of my speech for people that decided to kill people in cold blood. Right? Let me put it more bluntly. People lose any sort of compassion from the state or society or any sort of what you would consider to be the same freedom you enjoy when you start to take the life of another. Let me ask you just one final question about this, which is, you say we shouldn't dehumanize people. What happens when people stop to be human? Like Adolf Hitler. You think we should give him dignity?
I think we shouldn't stoop to the level we're trying to stop.
Okay. Well, let me finish one thing. I just want to highlight how incredibly dumb that statement was, because let me be very clear. The rule of law and the enforcement of it is a sword that needs to be used blindly, prudently, and with wisdom. But make no mistake, to say that, well, for example, we don't like people that take the life of another, therefore we should not take life of somebody else, it violates the American idea of justice, which is that you take the life and liberty of another, you're going to pay a price for that. And I encourage you to expand. We're going to get to the next question. Expand beyond Nietzsche. Just learn how to pronounce it, Nietzsche. You know, German guy that was right about some things and wrong about a lot, and maybe just read a little bit of Aristotle and Aquinas and Augustine, maybe a little Plato, then maybe you'll expand it a little bit. Thank you for your question. Thanks for being here tonight. Did not expect the whole thing on the Unabomber tonight, but here we are. So,
Hi, Charlie. Thanks for being here. You just mentioned pretty early on, pretty briefly, about how a lot of the struggle with conservatives is that we don't have the same place in visual media that the left does. I'm a media production major, specifically film, and so it's kind of disheartening to see the way that that profession has been taken over by the left and how kind of a lot of doors seem shut for people who want to spread, use that medium to spread pro-American messages. So I'm just wondering what has to happen for conservatives to carve out their place in visual media?
Yeah, so first of all, this is a great question. My wife and I were just talking about this, actually. The way that we view art is all wrong. I love art. I just don't like postmodern art, obviously. It's garbage. And so we need to do a better job of telling people what art actually is, which is the glorification of beauty, the pursuit and commitment to wonder, and hopefully the personification of the ideal and properly sold man. One of the reasons why conservatives tend to not like some of the people that come out of these graphic design schools is because they've been so propagandized to believe that art is what you make out of it, which is one of the most ridiculous things. I think it was Marcel Duchamp in 1920s who signed a urinal and was kind of the beginning of kind of this postmodern artist revolution where he said, this is now art because I want it to be. Like, no, it's not. That's not the way, maybe you could say that. You have a right to be completely wrong. So how does that tie to you? Is that we as conservatives, we need to get back into culture. Obviously, we hear this a lot, movies, entertainment, and art. But let's be very clear about the type of culture that we actually want to create. We want to create art that glorifies a pursuit and a relationship with your creator, that speaks favorably of the Western canon, of Shakespeare, of the books that built our entire civilization. Instead, we're doing the opposite. Instead, on Disney Plus, you can go be a graphic designer to go like tell 8-year-olds that transgenderism is normalized or whatever that crazy, right? That's like the new thing, which I think is completely and totally evil and wrong, where they have transgender people on Disney Plus and Nickelodeon or whatever. And so I would just say that what needs to be done is we as conservatives need to be more embracing of people that are artists. And this is the problem, is because some people say, well, artists are inherently disruptive and destructive. Now, there is a point and there's some truth to that, right? But good art does not destroy things that are beautiful. It does the opposite. Good art portrays things that are beautiful in a way that has not been done before. And so this is the whole idea of architecture, right? Don't get me started on architecture in America, which is mostly garbage, right? It's mostly utilitarian. You want to know the best example of American architecture going, now go look at a Dollar General. It looks like something out of a Soviet commissar in the 1970s, right? Like no windows, total box, built solely and strictly for the purpose of buying crap from China. Like that's what a Dollar General is for, right? And instead, we used to build buildings to have some sort of transcendent connection. So there's two very basic things that you should know about architecture. Number one, the circle is the perfect shape because there is no beginning, there is no end. It's an infinite symbol in its core. Number two, all buildings should point upwards because they point upwards towards transcendent order or to God. Very simple. Most European medieval architecture, Gothic architecture embodies this. People are really afraid to talk about this topic. I don't know why, because they kind of loop it into some sort of like, you're a terrible person because you're talking about architecture. No, I want to live in a society that is aesthetically pleasant and beautiful. Now, to answer your question, which was totally unrelated to that, which is, if you're going to get into the graphic arts and all of this, we need to do a better job as conservatives to embrace content creators and create those people. At the other side, if you have a passion for that, please try to form yourself into trying to glorify the good and to pursue the wonderful, not trying to disrupt things at work and be like, oh, this is a piece of art because it's like a Campbell soup can that has like been poured over, which is like some of the stuff in the, you guys ever see that video on YouTube where they had like the orange juice spill and they pretended it was a piece of art and people came by and took pictures of it? It's like they could be like, it really wasn't, but they persuaded themselves that it was, is that art should glorify the good, not destroy the ideal. So thank you so much.
Thanks, Charlie.
Hi, Charlie. I'm a little nervous, so bear with me. But I got kind of a two-parter. So first, over the summer, you had a debate with a YouTuber, Vosh, on the Tim Pool podcast. And you guys had a conversation about critical race theory in school and what the purpose of education should be. And if I remember correctly, you said something along the lines of the purpose of education should be to kind of breed gratefulness for being in an awesome, amazing country. Could you elaborate on that?
Yeah, that's a great question. Thank you for asking it. So education comes from a Latin word, which means to lead forth. It literally comes out of Socrates' allegory of the cave, well, Plato's allegory of the cave, as told by Socrates, of leading forth out of darkness into light. So there's this debate right now of what is education, right? Should education be kind of a buffet line where you present students with all the different options and they kind of choose for themselves? Or should education be hopefully a commitment to things that are objectively true and good and beautiful and leading young people towards what is the beginning of philosophy, which is wonder? Like, wow, there's a world so big outside of things that I'm just beginning to understand. And I know so little of it, but I want to go in the pursuit and the journey of maybe getting closer to it. So those are two different types of definitions, right? So one form of an educational definition is, you know what? We are going to try to sample every single ideology and kids and students choose for themselves. I think that's a mistake. Now, the downside is if you get really, really bad teachers, all of a sudden they're going to use that and they're going to be like, oh, well, we know Marxism is better than that. So at least we'd prefer the buffet line over serving, you know, bread lines of the equivalent of Marxism. Whereas in its ideal, though, in the classical sense, people that are teachers, people that want to lead forth, they need to be willing to make absolute objective claims in three categories: in ethics, in metaphysics, and in politics. That's not political parties, but in certain political systems. And so the correct and the ideal view of education should be that. Is it? It's so far from that, it's hard to believe. Anyone here classically educated, you kind of know what I believe here. Yeah, and you would know that it's not actually imposing those ideas. It's teaching the fundamentals of Greek, of Latin, and Hebrew, reading ancient and great books and getting closer towards that hopeful end conclusion of a better citizen. And so people say, Charlie, what does a properly educated man look like? A magnanimous man, someone that has character. Now, character comes from a Greek word which means imprint or tattoo. It's etched within you. A properly souled man with character is like the Grand Canyon, where good luck undoing that. Good luck trying to change that. That's what education should be. A properly souled man is like the Grand Canyon. Look at it, you're impressed. No matter how much rain, storm, or opposition happens, that stays in put. In fact, education is like the opposite of it. It's like a plate of spaghetti. It changes as you want to. There's no form of it. Does that answer your question, or is that beg another one?
Kind of, because I just feel like, can you move a little closer?
Yeah.
Because I feel like, I do agree with some of the things you said about education should be about objective truth and things like that, although I don't think necessarily ethics has like an objective morality to it all the time. But I just, the root of your argument with Vosh was kind of, he was saying how you were arguing that the purpose of school shouldn't to be to breed like mini activists.
That is true.
So from that, I kind of get the idea of whitewashing history a little bit in order to not like breed activism, when in reality, I don't think education should like ascribe morality to our country. It should kind of just be like you said, objective truth, history, and then they kind of will make out of it what they got.
Yeah. So I would never support whitewashing anything, obviously. I think that if you fairly and readily, you know, read the founders as they are, you'll realize these were incredible men, that they were born into a world that they did not create, that by the time that they were exiting the world, slavery was on its way out, that the first ever anti-slavery convention was hosted by Benjamin Franklin in Philadelphia in 1775. I could go on and on and on. But I think a proper view of history using original texts, actual quotes, and going into the actual context of the time, I think actually creates a sense of pride and a sense of gratitude for living in that nation. So happy to dive into that further. I don't think we're going to explore that, you know, much more, because I know we're low on time. But I'll say this final thing, is that this is where we'll have clarity but not agreement on this one issue. I believe there is an objective ethical code. I believe that there is an objective ethical code of how we treat people that are less powerful than us, of a proper way to organize society, of what the highest form of existence for a human being should be. I think one of the great roadmaps, in addition to the Bible, which is the greatest roadmap, but one of the roadmaps that isn't taught, is Aristotle's ethics, of what does a properly souled man look like? Courage, contemplation, justice, friendship, all these things that need to be wrestled with and asked the question about. I think that if we say that there's no such thing as objective morality, then we're in nothing more than a power dynamic, which some people in control of our country actually believe. But thank you so much for being here tonight. Appreciate it.
Good evening, Mr. Kirk. How are you?
Great.
Great. I just want to say thank you for coming first. And to those of you who disagreed with Charlie, thank you very much for coming. It's very admirable. I had the opportunity to go to YAFCON this past summer, and I got to ask the Honorable Kevin Brady this question. I think it's really important now, more so than ever, especially with the infrastructure talks going on in Congress at the moment. How do we get young Americans to care more about taxes than race?
That's a great question. You might not like my answer. Yeah, go ahead.
Kevin Brady actually refused to answer. He flipped it back on me.
Well, man, I'm going to answer it, so like that's
very
fine.
That's
yeah, I mean, I'm not a politician, nor do I want to be, so I actually answer questions and say things that are true, regardless of what CNN says. Yeah, I mean, well, first of all, just kind of like, obviously they should care almost nothing about race, but I will kind of say, because Kevin Brady's probably the wrong person or the perfect person to answer this question, I think he's way too fixated on taxes, to be perfectly honest. I think tax policy is not even close to the most important thing happening to our country, like not even close. We have a generation that doesn't share values. We have immigration policy that's intentionally harming us, the destruction of the American family, opioid epidemic, sexual anarchy. Like, if you were to say, like, this big trade-off, again, I don't like paying taxes. I pay way too much in taxes. You do too. Taxes should be lower. But the kind of pathological fixation that certain Republicans and conservatives have on, like, lowering corporate tax rates, when it's like, wait a second, divorces are going up, church attendance is going down, like, our morality is being put in question, and, like, your whole thing is, like, lowering corporate taxes, is, I think, kind of low on the totem pole of actual, like, society-bearing futures. And don't get me wrong. I'm all for free markets and lower taxes. But here's how I'll answer your question, which might not how you might expect it, which is we should care less about taxes. We should care more about race. Here's what we should care more about. We should care more about the nation, our fellow countrymen, our shared story, our history, and also a very simple question, which is this. What kind of society do you want to live in? Do you want to live in a society with super low taxes where no one speaks the same language, we all have a different interpretation of history, and we're kind of like the Singaporean colony? Or do you want to live in a country where all of a sudden families are getting back together, children are starting to be had again, where all of a sudden we are turning the corner away from some of the slippage morally I think we're having in our country, hopefully with immigration that prioritizes our fellow countrymen. Do you have a short follow-up?
Nope.
Okay. Thank you for that question, though. Appreciate it. So I want to thank our amazing Turning Point USA students. Let me just kind of summarize all this together. And thank you for the disagreements, by the way. I appreciate it. And that's courage. It really is. And thank you guys for being respectful of all that. It's very nice. And so a couple things in closing. Number one, I want to reiterate something I said earlier. If every single person commits themselves to being the same in public that you are in private, all of a sudden the number one form of censorship that has been occurring in America, which is self-censorship, starts to go away. The number one form of censorship is you shutting up you or us shutting up us. I do it too. When I get into a family gathering, sometimes I'm like, I don't want to deal with this right now. Like, not right now. That is a form of cultural censorship where all of a sudden we are allowing that pressure to dictate whether or not we are going to stand for what's right and for what we actually need to articulate. The other thing I'll say is this, which I want to reemphasize this, which is people say, Charlie, how do we win? We win when all of a sudden we stop allowing them to inflict the punishment. We win when all of a sudden we disempower them by showing no matter what you take from me, my salary, my job, my diploma, my friends who aren't really my friends, the thing that matters most is expressing the values and the ideas and the truths that do not change. This country's not going to be saved overnight. People don't like hearing this. We're in a tough spot. They control a lot, from Harvard to New York Times to Google to Facebook, which is like the weirdest 24-hour news cycle of Facebook I've ever seen, but whatever, to so many other different things. The question is this. The question is, will people that still believe in the same American story, believe the Constitution is the greatest political document ever written, that believe natural rights are given to you by God, that believe in life, liberty, pursuit of happiness, the laws of nature and nature's God, and believe in the promise of the Declaration that when in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands with another, that the separate equal stations are given to you by the laws of nature and nature's God? This is a very important question because we are now on that civilizational brink right now of whether we're going to go the direction that they want us to go, tribal warfare, tearing at each other's throats, or we could recommit ourselves. And it starts with this generation. 18, 19, 20, 21-year-olds in the audience and watching online, you were born into a world you did not create. So you have a choice. You could do the AOC thing where you complain about everything, you march in the streets, you say, my parents are a bunch of idiots, and, you know, give me a bunch of stuff. Or you could do this. Hey, I wish my parents would have been more involved in this, but I'm not going to blame them. It says in the Bible very clearly to honor your mother and father, because then you will live long in the land of which you are in. It's the only Ten Commandment with a promise. Instead, you should say, look, maybe my parents could have been more involved, but they gave me an opportunity to live in the greatest nation ever to exist in the history of the world. I have things more going for me than not. I'm going to be filled with gratitude, not anger and venom, and say, guess what? This generation, I'm telling you, we now have to lead the other generations that have been sitting idly by that either don't understand the stakes and circumstances, that are just kind of like, oh, things are going to go back to normal. They will only go back to how they were if we put them back to how they were. This is not a gravitational pull argument. Like, well, it's going to go back to how it used to be. So here's the final thing I'll say. When we do that, when we no longer allow them to inflict punishment on us, when we stand together as one and we offer a source of not just compassion, but also a source of catching people when they fall. Someone gets fired from their job, you support them because of their political beliefs, whatever it might be. Then all of a sudden, how do we win? We win with each person believing what you do actually matters. We win when all of a sudden we rise up and we dedicate ourselves to not caring about what other people say about us, but what is true objectively and the things that do not change. This country is a beautiful gift from God, everybody. And it's an honor to be here in this state alongside all of you. I want you to vision cast 10, 20, 30 years from now. I want to say the front page of the New York Times say the following. Sudden and shocking right turn happened post-COVID-19 pandemic when Generation Z and millennials rose up against CRT for freedom in the Constitution. I want to see that headline. I know you do too. We're going to win if we rise up. God bless you guys. Thanks so much for having us tonight.
Thank you so much for listening, everybody. Email us your thoughts, freedom@charliekirk.com. God bless you guys. Thank you for listening. Talk to you soon.
For more on many of these stories and news you can trust, go to charliekirk.com.